Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
We are on our last week with the letter from Birmingham Jail. This is our time to shift into, okay, what does this really do to us as white Christians in the 21st century? What does the letter from Birmingham Jail say to us? So I have just a couple of program notes around that. One is that we're not meeting next week because it's Easter. You'll be home unwrapping your hard-boiled eggs. Then the following week, the 28th, we're going to begin a quick four-week series to wrap up the year. We're going to look at climate change. Why does it matter? What do we know, really? What can be done? What can we do about it? So that's coming up in 2 weeks. Coming up on Thursday and Friday, not Maundy Thursday and Good Friday, although it happens to be those as well, like yesterday, found out about this. There's an exhibit and a symposium going on this is the Polk County Housing Trust Fund is sponsoring a symposium about basically designing for housing equity. That's the idea. But the interactive exhibit is called Undesign the Red Line. Undesign the Red Line. And this, I guess, is a traveling exhibit. So it is in Des Moines on Thursday and Friday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Franklin Junior High. And it looks at redlining, which has been a part of our conversation here. One of the ways that segregation worked throughout the country, not only in the South, is through the practice of redlining, which was basically zoning commissions and housing lenders in cahoots saying, this is where the African Americans are going to live, this is where the white people are going to live. So how did that shape Des Moines? How has that shaped West Des Moines? How has that shaped the built environment and the lived environment that we continue to be in? So Undesign the Red Line, Thursday and Friday. Okay, and I'll pass this around if anybody wants to sit, because it's pretty good. All right. So our final move as we look at the letter from Birmingham Jail is the call to speak up, the call for particularly us as white Christians in a white church to stand up and speak about racial equity. So I'm going to, again, let Dr. King have the first word here. I'm going to read, as soon as I find the right page, I'm going to read beginning at the bottom of page 3, and I believe I have read this paragraph to you before. I'm going to read it again. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time, hang on to that word, the myth of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait until a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. And I'm going to skip the next paragraph and resume at the top of page 4. I also had hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth of time. I received a letter this morning from a white brother in Texas, which said, "All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but is it possible that you are in too great of a religious hurry? It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth. All that is said here grows out of a tragic misconception of time. It is the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. I am coming to feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of good will. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. We must come to see that human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation." Comes through the persistent work of people willing to be co-workers with God. And Christian churches today responds, "We must view ourselves as stewards of time, and time is to be used effectively to further the ends of God's kingdom. Inaction reinforces the status quo. We cannot rest on the efforts of previous generations as if we had arrived at the end of their struggle. Rather, in awareness that, quote, people of ill will have used time much more effectively than have the people of good will, we must press on in doing right. Injustice persists, though sometimes in different forms, and previous civil rights victories are continually in jeopardy. As co-workers with God," see 2 Corinthians 6, 1-2, "we must never fall silent. This continued vigilance is particularly vital on behalf of children of color, who continue to inherit disadvantage in almost every arena of life. For children especially, the principle cited by Dr. King applies. Justice too long delayed is justice denied." So, white church, 56 years after Dr. King's letter, 56 years on Friday, this coming, no, 56 years last Friday, after Dr. King was, in fact, arrested. This coming Friday is Good Friday, which was the liturgical date when he was arrested, but it was April 12th. "Are there issues of justice that you feel strongly about, but you haven't been sure how to speak about them or act upon them? Are there issues of justice that you feel strongly about, but you haven't been sure how to speak about them or act upon them? What gets in the way? What keeps you from being a co-worker with God?" As Dr. King quotes the Apostle Paul.
In thinking about that, another question comes to mind. That, you know, we started out with the letter from the 8 clergy, mm-hmm. and then we got Dr. King's letter.
Right.
Was there any indication of how those 8 clergy took his letter?
Yeah, variously. So the 8 clergy who had written the letter to which Dr. King was responding so powerfully, largely struggled with the idea that they had been, essentially that they had been so wrong. And often they would describe feeling sort of almost unfairly. I don't think they even necessarily would have used quite those words, but had been really struggling with the way that they kept kind of coming up against, well, here's what you said and what Dr. King said back at you. And a few of them did sort of by the ends of their lives come around to saying, yeah, he was absolutely right. But boy, that would be a hard letter to have actually directly, literally addressed to you, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so they really struggled with it by and large. In a way that we don't necessarily have to struggle with it, but we ought to, because they were directly, literally addressed by the letter. There's only one of those eight clergy who is actually mentioned by name in the letter. It's clear to what letter King is responding, but only one of them is addressed by name, and Dr. King is careful to use it in a sort of a almost a, not quite a backhanded congratulations, but a very qualified congratulation that one of those clergy had welcomed a group of Negro worshipers into their congregation, into their worship service, not as members of the congregation, but into their worship service on Palm Sunday just prior to this. And so that pastor is named so-and-so, I know that you did this, that was great. I wish you had done more. So it's a very qualified thank you, but that's the only person who's named by name in the letter. But obviously they had gone in the newspaper of record with this criticism that Dr. King is responding to. So they didn't like it. No one addressed by this letter liked it. And it's kind of like reading the prophets. You know, if you read the prophet Amos and you like him, you probably don't understand what he's saying. If you read the letter from Birmingham Jail and all you do is like what Dr. King is saying, you white Christians in the 21st century, if you read that and you like what he's saying, you probably have missed the point. I think the experience of the eight clergy who had written the original letter probably bears that out.
Would you say that last part one more time, that if I read this and it made sense to me, I missed the point?
If you read it and you like it, you've missed the point. If it makes sense to you, that means you're making progress. But if you read it and you like it, okay, you're missing the point.
Thank you.
Which is, I'm quoting somebody else who has said that about the prophets, that if you read the Hebrew prophets and you like what they're saying, then you've missed what they're saying.
So I can read it and understand it maybe, but I may not like it.
Right.
You may have fallen on the wrong side of the equation and said something.
Right. And and I would say that in general, we in this room are on the wrong side of Dr. King's equation. Not even necessarily for want of trying, right? But in general, Dr. King would continue to be disappointed in a Presbyterian church that is 91% white in 2019. With a Presbyterian church that is not sure how to have a conversation about race and how do we actually resolve the long history of racial injustice in our country. I think he would continue to be disappointed in us, certainly for the 91% white thing. Dan?
Well, I guess personally, as a white person, when you see the anger that they have, and it's justified. I mean,
right.
They've been put down. I mean, they're in poverty. Where do you go? And then it's like, oh my gosh, how do you address this? They have these attitudes. I mean, it's justified that they do, but then how do you get them to trust white people? I mean, it's just a whole
thing. Right, yeah. So I think that's a great response to the, you know, are there issues that you want to speak out on and you don't know how, what gets in the way? I think the anger that, as you say, is justified, anger is really hard for us to deal with. And as, you know, that's a white cultural thing too, right? In addition to being an uncomfortable human thing. But it is particularly an American white thing, an upper Midwest thing in particular, that we don't do anger, right? We just don't do anger. You know, if what I just said makes you mad, you make a quick little joke about it, right? Or you just swallow that. I didn't even hear the joke, so I don't know if it was directed at me, although it should have been. you know, we either deflect anger with humor, or we just sort of swallow anger and then take it somewhere else, right? But this is part of how white Midwesternism works, right? This is a cultural way of working with anger. Now it's neither good nor bad, right? But it means that we are uncomfortable with expressions of anger, and it means that we tend to part of the ways that we stereotype other cultures, whether racialized cultures, other white cultures, you know, sort of the stereotypes of, you know, Italians, right? And the way that they're sort of always on a, like, rah, right? That's a particularly sort of upper Midwestern, it's not exclusively upper Midwestern, but a certain way of being white, looking at a different sort of cultural expression of anger that is much more expressive about feelings in general, right? It's not only anger that we're uncomfortable with. We're kind of uncomfortable with any expression of emotion other than sort of bland happiness, right? So when we look at a contemporary activist movement, whether we're looking at, you know, if you remember the Occupy movement of a few years ago, which was not a particularly racialized movement, although it had racial justice kind of on its radar, if you look at Black Lives Matter, if you look at the ways that many people are engaging around immigration, if you look at the ways that people are expressing the set of resentments that are sort of the Make America Great Again box, there is a whole bunch of white supremacy in that box. There are also things that are not obviously tied to white supremacy in that box. There's a lot going on in there. But when we look at an angry movement, what do we do? We back off. We don't want anything to do with that, right? That discomfort with anger is a particular cultural way of trying to deal with it. We're just going to sort of exclude anger from our conversation, which means that we don't know how to deal with very real, understandable anger. And so when we look at Black Lives Matter, we say, "Ooh, that's too much. There is so much, you know, centuries of racial injustice built into the system, and when you see that that causes pain for people who have experienced it, it turns out that that's hard for us." So part of our invitation, as people who want to work for reconciliation, and I'll just assume we all want to work for reconciliation in some way, shape, or form, is that part of what we need to do is to become more comfortable with other people's anger. And probably to become more comfortable with our own anger, he says to himself, to be able to say, oh yeah, I know what makes me angry and why. I can recognize what makes Jean angry and why. I can recognize what makes Kent angry and why. I can recognize what makes people of color who are not in this room right now angry and why.
I think one of the things that you alluded to is culturally, we were all raised to suppress our anger.
Right. Yes.
And not say anything about it. One of the things that makes me really angry is the fact that Trump can just call people names and totally destroy an individual, and you don't know how to react to that. The current Democrats are trying not to fight back against it the only person I've heard right now that can fight back against it a little bit has been Buttigieg, where he's called Pence out and on different things, but he still doesn't want to get into a big fight, but he's still as Midwestern as the rest of us on where,
which is,
what do you do with it?
Which is part of why he, among the Democratic field,
is starting to take the lead.
Well, A, is part of, it is part of what has contributed to his sort of sudden rise to contender status. I think that was not as obvious as it might have been. But who gets to be angry in public and still be taken seriously is actually white men. And especially Midwestern white men, right? Because if I, Midwestern white man, am going to be angry in public, then I must have a really good reason, because that's not how my culture normally would train me to be. I want to try to be as even-handed as I can, sort of around the knowledge of political differences that also track in this instance with some personality differences and ways of expressing this anger. I would submit that the President of the United States ought to be kinder in public. I think that there's just, when you've got that kind of power, what you say should be held to a higher standard. Dr. King talks about the church needing to be held to a higher standard as well. We're actually going to turn to that in just a moment. But notice also the racial cultural permissions around who gets to be angry and get taken seriously for it, and who gets dismissed for being angry. Mm-hmm. So a Latina woman from Brooklyn is going to sound angry to everybody, white people, is going to sound angry to white people not from Brooklyn, because there's a cultural stereotype going on there that comes with speech patterns, and it comes with ways of addressing people, and it comes with just different transparencies of, you know, can you see this person's emotion? If you look, step back a president, and you look at the times and the places when President Obama chose to look angry. Now, partly, he started to look angry at about 4, where President George W. Bush before him didn't start to look angry until he was about at an 8 or 9, because of the cultural stereotypes around angry white men is not a stereotype, angry black man is a stereotype. So there are ways that this is also playing out around these racial stereotypes, which means that there are also gender stereotypes in there, incidentally. If you have a if you have a presidential primary debate, say hypothetically, between Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Barack Obama, only one of those people gets to be angry and get taken seriously, and it's Joe Biden.
That's debatable.
Whether people took Joe Biden seriously is a different question, but his anger is not going to get him dismissed. Because it's sort of, it's out of character for the stereotype, right? So if I'm going to look angry, I've got reason for that. If I'm going to push back, I've got reason for that, because I'm a white man. So there's a gender layer to this too, and a race layer, which means that Elizabeth Warren is going to sound unduly angry. Kamala Harris is going to sound really unduly angry if they were performing the same level of anger. So this is all part of the, you know, looking at it from the political science standpoint. This is all part of the territory that these individuals are navigating as they work through the cultural, social rules. And in a large multicultural nation such as we are, to navigate the cultural, social rules all the way from Bangor to Brooklyn to Des Moines to Los Angeles, that's a terribly complicated thing to do. And it's going to tend to pull candidates toward white male. Because white male is still sort of the dominant cultural self-presentation, cultured and gendered and raced self-presentation. So that sort of, you know, on the one hand, I should step back into wanting to honor the real legitimate anger about the tone of discourse and particularly the tone of discourse coming from the most powerful Twitter account in the land. That is a problem, whatever one thinks about the individual and the policies being promoted. That the tone is a problem because of the power that goes with it. And it's really telling to me that it's a white male who happens to be the one who is kind of finding his footing in the mix of voices around them.
Nathan, I was thinking of the contract and the support that Covenant gives to Head Start, and thinking that it's a very positive thing, a very positive place, and Covenant does a good job maintaining that contract. I wonder if that stops us from doing any more, if we think that that is our contribution to racial, what would our goal be? Racial mixing or rights or minority rights,
right,
or anything like that? How easy,
right,
it is to get to a certain point and say, well, we've done,
right,
we've done our part.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not discounting what we do. I think,
right,
it's a great ministry. But
yeah, so there is a piece of, you know, look how far we've come can become a way of saying we don't have to come any farther, right? And partly we have to think about that in terms of the way that we tell this history, right? The way that we tell the history of the civil rights era, we call it an era, which eras are always in the past, right? So it's this time when some things happened and that was great. I mean, the things that happened at the beginning were less great. By the end, it was definitely great. Now we're fine. We tend to tell the history in that way. So, you know, Rosa Parks wouldn't move to the back of the bus. Dr. King led the March on Washington. Somebody shot him, that was bad, but that was it, right? Then we're done. The Civil Rights Act passed, and now everything's fine, which leads us, as a white majority, to then look at, say, a movement like Black Lives Matter, and say, where did that come from? Right? Or to look at the Los Angeles riots in 93, was that? And be like, where did that come from? Like, the police beat up one guy, and all of a sudden the whole city burns down. As if that was not just one incident in a long history of attempts to continue securing more justice. I want to step all the way over here into MAGA land again, because the way that sort of mainstream commentators and observers have looked at this sort of where did all of the swirl of impulses and ideas that want to make America great again, where did those come from? And again, there are long-standing structural economic problems cooked in here. There are long-standing structural racial resentments cooked in here. There are people who just wanted to elect a Republican cooked in here. So there's a lot going on over here, and if we act surprised at it, part of what we're doing is we're saying that that's weird and not like us. Or some part of this is weird and not like us. We may say, well, I voted for the guy, but I'm not like them. Which is actually not unlike saying, I agree with the goals you seek, but not your methods of direct action, right? So the ways that we characterize whatever other we're going to characterize, and certainly if we say, well, I didn't vote for the guy and you're crazy, that's that same work. It's the same. It's that same work of putting somebody else over here. They're different from us. We're not going to understand that. We're just not even going to try. I'm not saying that these are comparable things to understand. Right? White supremacy and Black Lives Matter are different at the level of one is trying to perpetuate a racial injustice, one is trying to protest a racial injustice. But the way that we view the other, the way that we categorize whoever, whatever other that we've just set up, what we're doing partly is saying that's over there. Part of the way we often tell the history of the Civil Rights era is that was then, this is now. As if there's a clean separation, either between us and them, or us and past us. So here's Dr. King talking to us about the church's place in that sweep of history. Obviously, he wasn't talking directly about the current social and political divisions that we face, but he wasn't missing a point of those either. This is in the middle of page 5. There was a time when the church was very powerful. It was during that period that the early Christians rejoiced when they were deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was the thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Wherever the early Christians entered a town, the power structure got disturbed and immediately sought to convict them for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. Notice he's claiming language for the early Christians that has been applied to him. But they went on with the conviction that they were a colony of heaven and had to obey God rather than man. They were small in number, but big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. They brought an end to such ancient evils as infanticide and gladiatorial contest. Things are different now. The contemporary church is so often a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. It is so often the arch supporter of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's often vocal sanction of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If the church of today does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authentic ring, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. I meet young people every day whose disappointment with the church has risen to outright disgust. Dang.
Yeah.
Yeah, still true today. The question of, is the church relevant? And not, is the church relevant, like, to, you know, people's lives and felt needs and whatever, but is the church relevant to the world in which we actually live? Oof.
Irrelevant social club.
Irrelevant social club.
Yeah, it's pretty.
He's got no time for us.
Maybe you could confirm a long-standing rumor or assumption that the threat of the IRS terminating the church's nonprofit status, I guess for lack of a better phrase, to keep the pastors and the church from getting too outspoken and too political, is that really true, that the status of our nonprofit status, or our code, or however we're ranked by the IRS,
right,
would be in jeopardy? Is that the big club that's been there?
It's a very small club.
Is an error now
from my perspective. It's the Johnson Amendment is what it's called, as a particular amendment to a piece of the tax code. What it prohibits us from doing as a religious nonprofit is specifically endorsing or counter-endorsing specific political candidates. So that prohibits me from the pulpit, or us as an institution, from saying, you need to vote for so-and-so. We have a little bit more wiggle room on this side, but it's still dicey to say you need to vote against so-and-so. Now, I could tell you whom I voted for. I can tell you anything about issues, specific issues. I can, especially if I'm giving you theological, biblical rationale for approaching an issue in a certain way, that's pretty much fair game. But you need to vote for Elizabeth Warren in the caucuses next year. I'm not allowed to say that. You need to make sure that, I think a cat hit a Democratic candidate right now. You need to make sure that Buttigieg does not get elected. I really shouldn't say that either. But that's a very small club, because it's such a specific thing that I might be doing. The bigger club, I think, is the knowledge that that I don't want to rock the boat. Now, I'm interested in wobbling the boat just a tiny little bit, right? But I don't want to rock the boat so much that I fall out. So the deeper concern, I think, for the more pressing concern around political action of churches is, how do I keep the people in the pews? How do I make sense? I put the people in the pews. How do I keep the checks in the offering plate, right?
You're getting there.
So that's the more pressing concern, I think, for a lot of churches, around how do we engage in public witness, which is one way of thinking about what does it mean to be relevant. How do we bear witness in the public square? That's not really IRS prescribed.
So I would, from what you've said, this little narrow area about presidential candidates, mm-hmm. put that aside.
Right.
Maybe the rest of this, is it really the edicts from the denomination's national convention, i.e. what the Methodists just went through? Is that what prohibiting what churches do? Is their own hierarchy?
There's a lot of own hierarchy in there. There's a general sort of thrust of sort of Presbyterian social witness that I try to stay roughly inside. I don't necessarily agree with everything as a denomination we say on particular issues. There's sort of an office at the General Assembly level that works specifically around social witness and a committee that studies and puts statements together around that, that we as individual Presbyterians are free to agree or disagree with, because we're Presbyterians and we have freedom of conscience. I would say that really more, and the thing where the contemporary church becomes a weak, ineffectual voice is that I don't necessarily know what you think about absolutely every issue, and so I'm going to avoid talking about those issues because I don't want to make you mad.
I think that part's true,
yeah.
Even in just our own social
yeah.
situation.
Right.
And I think one of the other things that I'm encountering is you get so comfortable that, you know, if you see this going on, especially, we don't have a lot of interaction. First of all, think about Minnesota, think about in most areas, mm-hmm. and Wisconsin and Iowa and et cetera, we're pretty white.
Right.
If you don't have the interaction, except maybe in these small groups, and then you really don't, unless you make it to go in. I was just thinking, one of my mother's favorite sayings was walk a mile in some other person's shoes. I don't know if I were a black person, if I would even want to come to this church.
Right.
Just because I don't know how I would be accepted, or why would I want to put myself into that situation? So the couple times that we've had people of a different race mm-hmm. come, you wonder, so if we are overtly friendly, does that look like, oh, we're so glad to see you, are you going to come back? Or do they feel like, well, they're only doing that because I'm a black person? I don't know how they react, because we don't actually maintain some of those people. We have over the years had families
right.
come, but they don't stay.
Right. So so one of Dr. King's famous lines was that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. We worship at 10 o'clock to avoid that. But I don't think you can truly effectively desegregate at the level of the worship service. I think you have to begin with desegregating at the level of whom do you actually know and interact with? Where is our sort of trip through the world, where is that segregated? And how do we desegregate that? Segregation is also not just a matter of whom do you actually interact with, but how do you interact? Whom do you interact with as equals, as opposed to interacting with as glorified or unglorified staff? So how do we interact differently in the world? And part of the barrier here is not just our discomfort with anger, which is where we started, but our discomfort in general, our discomfort with uncertainty, going into spaces that we're not actually in control of, or choosing not to be in control of the space that we're in. How do we actually take that step into relationship, as opposed to waiting for someone else to sort of do that work for us?
I was thinking about when the Sudanese came to Chinese Grove all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, most of them didn't even speak English here. Mm-hmm. So we got to know a few of them, but I mean, and they had their separate services. And also what was interesting is they didn't identify with the black issues that others do because they didn't grow up with that.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, so man, once you get to know people, it's way more complicated than just not knowing them.
Yeah.
Right? It's a whole lot easier if you can just go through not knowing anybody, which is a way of not doing the work, right? It's a way of not stepping into that discomfort. And part of, I think, the part of what Dr. King's letter is going to say to us, this is our little wrap-up sermon, part of what it's going to say to us is, man, people of color have done the work, are continuing to do the work of just surviving in a world that is coded by whiteness, a world that is structured by whiteness for our convenience. And it's not their job to always be the ones being uncomfortable and stepping out to take risks into relationship. That's our work to do as well. So there's your assignment. It's Holy Week. Step out somewhere uncomfortable into relationship with someone who is not like you. Like, really seriously not like you. Go in peace. See you in
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.